I'm really continuing where I left off this afternoon. But before I get back to that, and an explanation, I think, of what Waugh meant when he said the book is about God. The first edition that appeared in England had a little warning on its dust jacket. It didn't appear on American editions, but let me read this, because he was aware he was putting forward to the public something very different from what they would expect or what they had known his work to be in the past. And hence it came with this little warning. When I wrote my first novel 16 years ago, my publishers advised me, and I readily agreed, to prefix the warning that it was meant to be funny. Now, in a more somber decade, I must provide them with another text and, in honesty to the patrons who have supported me hitherto, state that Brideshead Revisited is not meant to be funny. There are passages of buffoonery, but the general theme is at once romantic and eschatological. It is ambitious, perhaps intolerably presumptuous, nothing less than an attempt to trace the workings of the divine purpose in a pagan world, in the lives of an English Catholic family half-paganized themselves, in the world of 1923 to 1939. The story will be uncongenial alike to those who look back on that pagan world with unalloyed affection and to those who see it as transitory, insignificant, and already hopefully past. Whom then can I hope to please? Perhaps those who have the leisure to read a book word by word for the interest of the writer's use of language. Perhaps those who look to the future with black forebodings and need more solid comfort than rosy memories. For the latter, I have given my hero, for the latter I have given my hero, that is rosy memories, and them, if they will allow me, a hope, not indeed that anything but disaster lies ahead, but that the human spirit, redeemed, can survive all disasters. Just absolutely magnificant. The human spirit, redeemed, can survive all disasters. Made the claim the book is about God. Now, how do you write a book about God? And quite clearly, it presents an artistic problem, especially as he defines in that preface that he's writing about the operation of divine grace within the world. In order to do this, he designs a novel in which he tries to chronicle the presence of God and God's operations through grace indirectly by showing the impact of that grace on the lives of human beings. It is not obviously possible to show that grace directly, although we do see many characters who are moved by that grace, and the whole novel builds to that great deathbed scene and that final moment of grace for Lord Marchmain. But we do see that impact operating in one way or another, either being accepted or rejected by many of the characters. God's grace is present throughout the novel. Some accept it, some reject it. Some are dragged, kicking and screaming, if you will, against their will, by God's grace, to a good end. Others simply know it all along and move quite comfortably to that end. But in order to make that point, and this is what I need to underline, because it is very easy to misunderstand this book. If we are going to have a starting point and an ending point, and that ending point is going to be a character or many characters who will finally accept God's grace and act on it, then we must begin the novel without grace. We have to begin the world, almost by definition, the world of the novel, as a place in which it is difficult to find God's grace. And we have to have many of the characters who quite clearly from the start are without grace. Now the reason I bring this up is that there are things in the novel that are disturbing to many readers. This is a novel that is filled with sin. There's no getting around it. I'm not going to run through a complete catalog, but I suspect you can find all seven of the deadly sins in here, one place or another. Some of them are more prominent than others. This is not, obviously, the author reveling in that sin. And I would make the point that in some of the most disturbing or extreme moments when he is presenting that sin, he does it the way a great artist should. That is, at a slight remove, with style, a kind of style where it is almost possible to read over some of the more disturbing passages and not even be aware of what's happening. But at the same time, for those who know and understand, it's clear what is happening there. These are sinful characters. And if you're writing a novel about the modern world, how could they be anything other than that? It is the world he had known. It is the world that he said had rejected God. The world that, as he wrote to his brother on one occasion, needs more religion. And by that, he's not speaking generically. He's speaking of the Roman Catholic faith. That's what the world needs. If it doesn't have it, then you're going to have characters who are sinful characters. That is there. It would be entirely possible to take these same materials in the hands of a bad novelist and make an extraordinarily offensive novel. Particularly in our day and age, you can just imagine what an inartistic or tasteless writer could do with these same materials. I'm emphasizing Waugh, who in the past was quite ready to shock an audience, in this novel does not attempt to shock. That is not his point. But he must reflect. One of the duties of the artist is to hold a mirror up to nature. The artist must reflect that reality of the time and age in which he lived and which he knew, because those are his materials. It is the rare writer that can write elaborate fantasy and make it believable, but if you even go to most fantasies, you're going to find they are still rooted in a particular age and time, even if they are fantastic in detail. So, as we go through this, yes, there are some unpleasant things we will touch on. It is necessary in order to come to that moment, to have indeed a pilgrimage out of that modern world, out of the enslavement of sin, toward that moment when God's grace acts on these lives. I quote Waugh again. Many modern novelists, since and including James Joyce, attempt to represent the whole human mind and soul, and yet omit its determining character, that of being God's creature with a defined purpose. And if you, Waugh's point, if you leave that notion out of the novel, you cannot have a whole novel because you cannot have complete characters. What defines human nature is that we are creatures of God and we have a defined purpose. Now, he does something in the novel by giving us a first-person narrator that is unusual. The earlier novels do not have that. He creates a character who's telling us the story. And we are beginning in the little prologue, which is set in 1942, with Charles Ryder in the midst of World War II, who is, as he begins the novel, giving us a sense of the time and place in which he finds himself in the midst of war. If this book were religious propaganda rather than literature, Charles, from the beginning, having converted, and we learn that he has converted, but not till the end of the book, would be upbeat and chirpy and handing out rosaries to his fellow infantrymen. There are occasions when even Catholics become discouraged. There are times when events can overwhelm any individual. And as the book begins, Charles is in a state where he finds himself drained, if you will, or emptied of meaning. Look at the very first paragraph of the prologue, and this again is Waugh the master. Any good introduction to anything should give you the major themes. He does it here right away. When I reached C Company lines, which were at the top of the hill, I paused and looked back at the camp, just coming into full view below me, through the gray mist of early morning. There's the entire novel in miniature in one sentence. What is happening is our narrator has climbed to the top of a hill. He is pausing and he is looking back. The title is Bride's Head Remembered. This is going to be a novel of retrospection and memory. At this point, he's just looking back at the camp, but the bulk of the novel will be him looking back at his immediate past. And that, as he looks back, the camp comes into full view below him. Why do we look back? Why do we reminisce? Because when we are moving through life and are in the midst of any event, action, point in time, we cannot see it all clearly. I tell my students, and I'm more and more convinced of it as I grow older, that as things happen to you in this life, you very often don't understand when you're in the midst of them what's going on or why it's happening. But always, if you look back, you will see a pattern or a design that makes sense. That's what this novel is doing. It is assuming that by looking back and retracing steps, one can find a design, find a purpose. Of course, here we have merely an artistic creator who is designing and creating the narrative, and a complex narrative it is. I'll get to that in just a moment. But what he is doing, if you will, is giving us a sense that in the larger sphere of all human life, there is design because there is a divine creator who is given a divine defined purpose for each human being. And our job is to cooperate with that grace, cooperate with that will, and find what that defined purpose is. I looked back at the camp just coming into view below me through the gray mist of early morning. And it is not easy to see the past clearly or honestly. And that's what Charles is going to do throughout the entire book. This is our prologue. This is our prologue. There is an epilogue. It will come right at the end. We're going to be back in 1942. We will return here at the very end of the novel. And then the novel is broken into two unequal parts, or two unequal books. But each book has a particular design. Before we get to that, anchoring ourselves again in the prologue itself, we get more of the sense of who this man is. And what has happened to him? And we're getting an echo in the present moment of the story of his life. We were leaving that day when we marched in 3 months before. The place was under snow. Now the first leaves of spring were unfolding. We have spring on the horizon. We're on the brink of spring, but it's still midwinter. But those first shoots are coming up. It is a hopeful beginning, but winter still dominates. I had reflected then that whatever scenes of desolation lay ahead of us, I never feared one more brutal than this, and I reflected now that it had no single happy memory for me. That's the present. That's the present. There is no happy memory. By the time he leaves, look at the final sentence of the novel, at the end of the epilogue. I think we all have basically the same edition. Page 351 here. As he leaves, I'm looking at the last two sentences. I quickened my pace and reached the hut which served us for our anteroom. "You're looking unusually cheerful today," said the second in command. By the time the book ends, there has been a total change in attitude. And what will happen is there will be another happy memory that our narrator can hold to, but very different from anything he can imagine as the novel begins. He is in a state of desolation. He doesn't think anything can pull him out of it. At the end of the novel, he is unusually cheerful. It's because of events. It's because of design. It's because of signs he's been given. And we have that transformation. And it is not, if you will, of his own working. Here love had died between me and the army. Falling out of love with the military. I see it happen to my students 20 times a day. The military life is not a congenial one. But please notice that all through this novel, again, what are we getting? It's second paragraph. It's a complete sentence. It's only a sentence. Charles Ryder seeking love and having love die. Just very quickly, here the second paragraph, that sentence, that one sentence paragraph structures the whole book for us. At the beginning of part one, Charles Ryder is a failed young man. He doesn't know himself. He doesn't know who he is. He's coming out of a desolate world with no sense of belief, no sense of self, no sense of purpose, no idea of anything, simply going through the motions as other young men go through the motions, go to Oxford. Throughout book one, in meeting Sebastian, and through that romantic friendship with Sebastian, he thinks he has found a kind of love. But the love fails. And what we watch, and it is that painful chronicle through book one, of Sebastian falling to pieces and Charles having no idea how to help him, what to do. Saying, in fact, at one point, how could I help anyone who could so little help myself? By the end of book one, he has become a real artist. But accompanying that, Lady Marchmain dies. The two events, almost simultaneously. He's in Paris. He's studying. He's going to be successful. But we have a pattern there. The failed young man becomes a successful artist. In the midst of it, to get him to becoming an artist, it has been, he thinks, out of a real love, it's not a real love. It's a romantic friendship that fails. And simultaneously, the mother of the young man dies. We end with book one, Lady Marchmain's death, the closing of the chapel at Brideshead. Book two. We begin with Charles Ryder, the failed artist. He's coming back from Latin America. He's done these paintings. Everyone thinks they're wonderful, but we're going to learn from that harshest and most severe critic, Anthony Blanche, that they're not good. In fact, Anthony Blanche calls them an imposture. And is really abusive. We'll look at the scene. Cruel in his evaluation. Charles has now failed as an artist. But he thinks he's found love with Julia, for whom, he says, Sebastian was the forerunner. And, of course, all through the book, there's the discussion of the similarity between brother and sister. They look alike. They have the same features. They have many of the similar attitudes. Sebastian, at one point, says, my sister is very like me. That's why I don't like to spend much time around her. Although she doesn't have my character. I couldn't love anyone with my character, says Sebastian, which is a witty line, but part of that self-hatred that we're going to find in him that causes his self-destruction. That alcoholism is self-destruction. He thinks he finds love with Julia, and of course that love fails. But at the end of the second book, he becomes a real saved soul. But what has it taken? Lord Marchmain's death. I mean, this is a very simple structure, but it is artistic perfection. Failure to success. Failed man to successful artist. Failed artist to successful Catholic, finally. Finding his way, coming into the church. What has gotten him there? A false love. A love that he thinks is real, but in each case is a false love. A love that we watch fail. The first one, because of Sebastian's self-destruction. The second one, because Julia returns to the faith. And in each case, the mother dies at the end of book one, the father dies at the end of book two, and what do we discover when we get to the epilogue? The chapel's reopened. Chapel closed at the end of book one, chapel opened when we come to the... Everything is balanced. It's what I said about Waugh as cabinet maker. This is a very simple design and structure. You read the novel, you don't see it. And yet, it is, if you will, the skeleton, the basic design that's operating under the book. There are, however, other structures going on at the same time. We'll look at some of them. But what we're doing here is simply getting a sense. What is this whole journey about? It's the pilgrimage of a single soul. It's about the salvation of Charles Ryder. It's that one soul receiving grace, and along the way, having come in contact with the Flight family, grace is everywhere. And by the end, we have a large number of characters who indeed are saved. Now, please notice as well, there's a subtitle to this novel. The novel is called The Sacred and Profane Memories of Captain Charles Ryder. Captain, he's writing, the book is being written while he's in the military, the war is on. It is sacred, that's the ending, that's what we're heading for. Charles becomes a Catholic. And insofar as grace works on his soul and he finds the true faith, then that pilgrimage is a sacred pilgrimage. But in order to get him there, it's a profane pilgrimage, and the profaneness comes out of the fact that these characters are immersed in the modern world. They know the modern world, and Waugh is going to give us the modern world. Just as he had in some of the earlier novels, but now humanized, real human beings moving through that modern world, which is desolate, godless, empty. And in the midst of it, we get profane love. We get sinful love. But it somehow is moving toward, because it seems to be God's providential plan, the fact that Charles will finally, through grace, come into the church. What we're getting is a double perspective. One narrator, two perspectives. That is, Captain Charles Ryder, who's writing the book, and please notice, Waugh emphasizes that sense of pilgrimage. The character's name is Charles Ryder. Okay? That sense of movement forward. That sense of movement forward. Many of the names have that kind of significance. I'll mention some others later. But we are at a particular point in time as Charles writes, looking back on his younger self. We get the perspective of age looking back on youth. We have, if you will, two Charles Ryders. The one who is writing about himself as the young man. And that double perspective is extremely important. And in that sense, you could almost view this as one of those novels of education, a novel of growing up, a novel of maturing, and it is that. But it is also collective, because we care for more than just the principal character. In the original manuscript, Waugh included an epigraph at the beginning of the book. For some reason, he dropped it when it was published. Epigraph being a little quotation from somewhere else that's put at the front of a book to help explain it. And the epigraph is from Hebrews 13, verse 14. And the epigraph is, "For we have not here a lasting city, but we seek one that is to come." And of course, in terms of it being a memory novel, there is no lasting city. Everything that makes up the core of the novel is memory. It's gone. It is all vanished. And what Charles is seeking is something permanent and in terms of love, which he can only find in love of God, and something to anchor him, which of course cannot be the worldly city. This is right out of St. Augustine. And by the way, St. Augustine permeates much of this book. We'll see him popping up at other places. But the notion that the city of God stands in opposition to the city of man. The two cannot be one. They are in opposition. And the city of man will vanish, will go. It is corrupt. It is profane. The city of God is eternal. We seek one that is to come, and that is Charles's search. But again, we're talking that lasting city, and a city is made up of many, not just one. In the same way, at the very end of book one, that wonderful discussion, Charles has been painting in London at March Main House before it gets torn down and a block of flats put up there. Again, that sense of the constant change. The modern world, ripping it down, putting up something new. In the neighborhood where I live in Annapolis, I keep suspecting that some year I'll have a year without construction work. They tear up the streets, they put down a new street. They tear up the sidewalks, they put down new sidewalks. They rip down a building across the street, they put up a new building. Now they're ripping down the hospital a block away and they're going to put up flats there, condos there. My new motto for America should not be "In God We Trust," but rather, "What can we tear up next?" It's just this insane desire to keep, let's rip it up and do something new with it. It's part of that false notion of progress. Well, March Main House, which we are told is quite beautiful, and we get the description of the beauty of the place, it's going to be ripped down and the flats going up. So Charles is painting it. The end of part one, he is a real artist. And in fact, we learn it's some of his best work, that he's inspired. The brush moves in his hand. But please remember who's there watching him as he paints. The lovely Cordelia, who just sheds grace wherever she goes, except to Rex Mottram on one occasion. We'll look at that. We'll look at that. See, it's almost as if Cordelia is his muse there by his side as he paints. And then she asks, there's no one there, will he take her out to dinner? And he agrees. And they go on. As they're walking, she talks about the chapel being shut at Brideshead. And then asks Charles if he's ever been to Tenebrae. Charles says, never. I'm on page 220. Charles says, never. Well, if you had, you'd know what the Jews felt about their temple. Quomodo sedet soli civitas. It's a beautiful chant. You have to go once just to hear it. I don't have to explain it to you. You know that, right? The first verse of the Lamentations of Jeremiah in the Tenebrae service. How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? And it's that sense of the desolation of the modern city, that worldly city that has turned its back on God. By the way, at the very end of book two, the very end of the epilogue that follows book two, very short epilogue, Charles is thinking over what's happened to Brideshead and says, again, page 351, the house built generation from generation, until in sudden frost came the age of Hooper. The place was desolate and the work all brought to nothing. Quomodo sedet soli civitas. He knows it now. He's been to Tenebrae. At some point, okay? At some point, he's been to Tenebrae. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He shifts out of that, but he echoes Cordelia's words. He echoes Cordelia's words. But again, we're talking about the city of man, and in terms of the city, a populace. We have a number of people here. Brideshead, in a sense, is desolate at the end. It's been taken over by the army. Everything that Charles thought at first was important about it and beautiful about it. The soldiers, we learn, have been romping through. They've destroyed some of the paintings he's done in there. They've knocked the heads off statues because he's learned art is impermanent. But of course, what he sees at the end is the tabernacle lamp that has been relighted, which is the sign of the city of God, that hope that is permanent and lasting. Which means if there is desolation in the earthly city, there is always hope in the heavenly city. And again, we get the balance. We get the balance. The point I am making here, the extraordinary structure of this book to begin with. Very carefully put together. I'm going to give you one other quick one. I could spend hours on this. Every detail is somehow in the course of the novel balanced, and there is nothing there that is not for a reason. Page 29. Charles is remembering the first time that he sees Sebastian at Oxford. And he says, he's going to the barber. And he said, I knew Sebastian by sight long before I met him. That was unavoidable, for from his first week, he was the most conspicuous man of his year by reason of his beauty, which was arresting, and his eccentricities of behavior, which seemed to know no bounds. My first sight of him was as we passed the door of Germer's, and on that occasion, I was struck less by his looks than by the fact that he was carrying a large teddy bear. It's just, you know, it's a wonderful. Of course, we find out the teddy bear is named Aloysius. He's come to the barber to get a hairbrush, and is having the name Aloysius engraved on it. For his teddy bear, says the barber, it had to have very stiff bristles, not, Lord Sebastian said, to brush him with, but to threaten him with a spanking when he was sulky. It's just, you know, this is a college undergraduate. And yet, the barber is charmed, just charmed. And we get that deadly charm that, again, Anthony warns against, the charm that permeates everything connected with this family. But Charles says, I, however, remain censorious, and subsequent glimpses of Sebastian driving in a hansom cab and dining at the George in false whiskers did not soften me. Although Collins, who was reading Freud, had a number of technical terms to cover everything. We peg him. Freud tells us what it is. Psychological problem. Okay, now we've got him fixed. Of course, what we're going to learn is, no, we have a mysterious, complex human being there. Not someone you can fix with a formulated Freudian phrase, but he's running around wearing false whiskers. Hiding behind his false whiskers, being somebody else behind his false whiskers, and it's one of the first times that Charles sees Sebastian. Charles comes back, opening a book one. Charles comes back, opening a book two, from his trip to Latin America and Mexico, having done the paintings. He's got whiskers. And the first thing he does when he meets Julia on the ship is have the whiskers shaved. And he's playing at games. He's hiding behind his whiskers. A tiny detail. Opening of book one, opening of book two. It's a throwaway. You'd never notice it. It's artistic precision and structure. And the book is loaded with this stuff. It's the reason why you can go back to it and back to it and back to it and be continuously delighted and surprised because you can't believe all of the complexity and the references. And at the same time, on a first reading, it is so elegantly and gracefully written that you can just sort of rush right through it very quickly. It's an easy and quick read because it is so well written. It has depth at any point you want to pause and stare at what the particular details are. Enough of that. But we do get, if you will, that peopled city, a whole family, a whole world and time, which is what the novel does best. Any novel gives us particulars. It's what makes and characterizes the novel. The novel is able to render complete and whole worlds. Moby Dick, the whaling industry, 19th century America. Scarlet Letter, Puritan New England. War and Peace, the Napoleonic Wars in Russia. Victorian England, David Copperfield. That's what novels do. because they can give you, through the accumulated detail, a sense of time and place. And this gives us Britain there, between the wars, what it was like. And not just Britain. We get World War II Britain, at least in the military camps, Oxford in the 20s, the bright young people in London, how the upper class lived, the world of politics in Rex. We pay visits to Venice. We get a glimpse of Paris, a fine French restaurant, the dinner with Rex, which is simply delightful. A hint of Latin America, what it was like to make a shipboard crossing at that time. He creates a believable, real world, and yet, as he creates it, we are told it is vanished already. Page 21. Everyone agrees that the Oxford pages are simply extraordinary, that what Waugh does here is capture his memories of what it was like to be an undergraduate at Oxford in the 20s. He does it through Charles going back and recreating that, remembering the first day he goes with Sebastian. They're off to visit Brideshead, but then we back up to Oxford. That day, too, I had come not knowing my destination. It was Eights Week. Oxford, submerged now and obliterated, irrecoverable as lioness. That is where the King Arthur supposedly had his court, in southwest England. Okay, the Oxford that Charles knew is now as distant and vanished as the world of King Arthur. It only lives now in legend, myth, and memory. Obliterated, submerged now and obliterated, irrecoverable as lioness, so quickly have the waters come flooding in. And the notion of the flood come and covering it over is a clear sense that for all of its beauty and all that Charles remembers, it had to be wiped out. It had to go. It couldn't last. And indeed, as it's presented to us, and we take a kind of delight in it, and Waugh revels to some extent in the memory because it was his youth, it was the world he knew, and we are enchanted to meet Sebastian and the luncheon parties, and Anthony Blanche, for all of his peculiarities, is very funny, and we get the wit and the style and the elegance and the grace and the reading from the wasteland and all of that. There's the recognition it's going to be swept away. It must be swept away. It's worldly, and therefore it will be swept away. It's going to be obliterated. What lasts? What lasts? The novel asks in its opening pages. What is lasting? It will tell us by the end. It will tell us by the end. This is our frame. Frame the very beginning. Looking back, Charles says, in referring to his loss of love for the army, I felt as a husband might feel who suddenly realized he was out of love with a wife. Of course, that's where we're going to be at the beginning of book two. Again, failure of love everywhere, in every sphere. And sadly, the least important and interesting is Charles's failure in love with his own wife. That shock when the second book begins, you realize he's married. Who's he married to? How did this happen? When did he get married? Well, he obviously took it about as seriously. It doesn't quite get mentioned. He gets married off page. And then we just move on. It's something he did. It is clearly Waugh's sense of his own first failed marriage. Done whimsically for no particular reason. And what did it mean? And the marriage fails. Love is failing throughout the book with only a couple of exceptions. Let me give you one now. The moment when Sebastian is in disgrace because of his drunkenness, and he says, I can't stay here, says to Charles, I'm coming to stay with you in London. And Charles says, well, I can't go right now. I have to say goodbye to your mother. I can't be impolite. And Sebastian says, well, do that, but I'll see you in London. He leaves. And Charles is leaving, and Cordelia runs up to Charles and says, will you see Sebastian in London? And Charles says, yes. And Cordelia says, will you give him my love? My special love. Remember, my special love. Now, Charles conveys the message to Sebastian, who doesn't even reply, changes the subject. And yet, our final vision of Sebastian, the last one to see Sebastian, the person through whose lips we learn about the probable end of Sebastian is Cordelia, because her love has not failed. She's gone to find him. She's been with him. There is love in the book that does not fail, but it is the love based on the highest love. And Cordelia, from the start, believes, unequivocally, unshakably. She is a scamp sometimes. And even as the truth teller in the novel, she tells a series of big whopping lies. I can't wait to read that passage. To somebody who probably deserves to hear them. That's not fair of me, but in any case. But it is love that cannot fail because it's rooted in the only thing that is real, the heavenly city. That which cannot vanish, that which cannot be taken away. What have we got? What have we got? Well, a big book about those two big issues. Father Doran was telling me last night, the small but thick book by Joseph Pieper in defense of philosophy, in which he says there are only two things that can shake a mind out of its stupor and get it thinking again, which is what the mind should do. Love and death. They're the two big events that can be so shattering that they start the reflective process. What does this all mean? Well, this is a big book about love and death. Love and death. That's what it's all about. Waugh knows that, and he uses it throughout the book. Now, the first part of the book, book one, Et in Arcadia Ego. Even in Arcadia, I am there. It's inscribed on the skull that Charles has at Oxford. After he's met Sebastian, he keeps the skull there, and it's on. Even in the midst of the beauty of Brideshead, the glory of those first days at Brideshead, when Charles goes with Sebastian and there's no one there, and they roam about the mansion and they drink all the wine that's being brought up, and they're learning to appreciate wine. It's just the sense, as he says, I believe I was very close to heaven in those days. Well, he wasn't really. But he was getting a little glimpse of something beautiful. But at that moment, even there, death is waiting. And the destructive force that is going to eventually descend on Sebastian is already there. I'm doing this a bit out of order. I'm not going directly through. Here's what I want to do next. You cannot talk about Charles without talking about the entire Flight family. Okay? They are central. It is their home that he is invited to and that he goes to. But please note the name again. If we had Charles Ryder, we now have the Flight family. And they're running from the church, many of them. They are in flight from the truth. They are in flight from what's been given to them. Particularly the branch of the family that most resembles the father, Lord Marchmain. And notice how the family divides in two. We have Lord Marchmain, who is the patriarch, who should be the one at Brideshead, ruling over his estate and ruling over his family, and he has flown the coop early on. He gets married. He builds the chapel as a wedding present for his wife. He goes off to war, and he can't bear to come back. Why? Because he, as Kara tells us, he hates her. He hates her. That intimate discussion between Kara and Charles in Venice, where she's talking about romantic friendship, and says it's not Latin, it's Northern. She says, I think it's good. It's good to have that kind of love for a boy first. Lord Marchmain had it for a girl, his wife. It couldn't last. Then she says, do you think he loves me? And Charles says, Carr, what embarrassing questions you ask. She says, no, but not the least little bit. He stays with me because I protect him from her. He hates her. You cannot know how he hates her. And he won't go back. Now, it's very odd, and I'll come to it in a moment, but let me just state very clearly, that hatred is defined for us. And it's defined for us, of course, by Cordelia, page 221. This is just after Lady Marchmain's death. Cordelia says, top of page 221, I got on best with her of any of us. but I don't believe I ever really loved her. This is Cordelia, who is a fountain of love. Of course, what she means is I didn't love her the way she deserved to be loved. Cordelia admits to failing in love. Not as she wanted or deserved. It's odd I didn't, because I'm full of natural affections, says Cordelia. It's absolutely just valid self-judgment. I never really knew your mother, I said. You didn't like her. She's like, every time Cordelia opens her mouth, zinger, you didn't like her. I sometimes think when people wanted to hate God, they hated mummy. Because it's wonderful. Waugh said in one of his letters that wrote to Nancy Mitford, who had said, well, interesting book, but what about Lady Marchmain? She said, I can't stand her. I can't stand her. I don't like her at all. And Waugh writes back and said, well, I don't like her either. Unfortunately, God does. And it's absolutely true that many of the best people in the world and the ones who make us toe the line and the ones who call us to duty and make us responsible and set the ideal and seem to practice the ideal and are living there the way that we know we should, we don't like them. We want nothing to do with them. They are a living reproach to those who know they are not living properly. One might say, it's what Archbishop Lefebvre was to all the other bishops. One might say it's what the society is now to the whole church. And hence the anger, the rage. How dare you set a good example for us? I sometimes think when people wanted to hate God, they hated mummy. What do you mean by that, Cordelia? Well, you see, she was saintly, but she wasn't a saint, okay? She's human. She had her failings. She was aware of them. No one could really hate a saint, could they? They can't really hate God either. When they want to hate him and his saints, they have to find something like themselves and pretend it's God and hate that. I suppose you think that's all bosh, she says. Well, Lord Marchmain hates Lady Marchmain. Sebastian hates Lady Marchmain, and Sebastian is his father's son, and he goes flying from her. Julia doesn't hate her mother, but she too says at one point, I didn't love her the way I should have. And Julia is her father's daughter. There's a reason why he leaves the estate to her. And those two children are indeed the descendants of Lord Marchmain, and they are referred to most often as Sebastian Flight and Julia Flight, and they're fleeing the truth. They're fleeing their mother. They're running as their father ran. The other two children, much more closely allied, and by this is true even in looks. I won't go through the passages, but what you will find is there's the description that part of the beauty of both Sebastian and Julia comes from the fact of the handsomeness of their father. It's called Byronic. Makes this incredible impression. Whereas we learn that Lady Marchmain has no such quality. She's rather stern. She is not that attractive in looks, nor are the two children most like her. Bridie, Anthony Blanche says it's sort of like he has some sort of Aztec mask over him. He's just insults come from Anthony in describing Bridie. And Cordelia, who has the innocence of a child at first, but then when she comes back after working in Spain, after being with the ambulance during the war in Spain, Charles refers to her as plain. And he talks about what a shame it was, all that burning love using itself up in serum injections. Meaning he doesn't yet understand that that's what burning love precisely does. But if you're doing that, you better believe you're going to look plain. As plain as her mother, okay? But so we've got the two lines. And of course, Bridie and Cordelia are devout. They're never shaken in their faith. As Lady Marchmain is never shaken in their faith. The family quite literally splits apart in two.